data. He is from Lintech. David received his PhD in physical chemistry from the University of Arkansas in 2004, where he studied the synthetic development of complex colloidal nanomaterials. After graduation, he worked for NN Labs and NN Crystal for over 7 years, where he focused on the commercial development of nanomaterials for biological and solid-state lighting applications. In 2012, Dr. Battaglia joined Lintech, where he is currently the chief technologist for the Industrial Science Group. In this position, Dr. Battaglia has focused on the development of technologies surrounding the application of nanomaterials and nanocomposites, plasma systems, carbon dioxide sequestration materials, and additive manufacturing technologies capable of enhancing versatility and solving relevant issues in industrial and commercial processes. So at this point, I would like to pass it over and thank Dr. Battaglia for preparing a presentation for us. He will give his overview of the technology, and then we'll have time for live Q&A. So I encourage you at any point to submit your questions. So David, I turn it over to you.
All right. Well, thank you for having me today. The presentation that I'm going to give today focuses on the enhancement of non-fouling membranes for water purification and recycling technologies. This was funded by a grant through the NIEHS SBIR program, and we did this there at Lintech in collaboration with Professor Emmanuel Gianellis' group at Cornell University. So I'll give you an overview of this project. The objective that we were focusing on was to develop an anti-fouling membrane technology that could enhance the purification of contaminated wastewater sources. For wastewater, there are some specific improvements necessary to really bring membrane purification to the limelight for many different areas. And some of the focuses for improvement are the reductions of water flow due to membrane pore plugging, mineral scaling, reductions in membrane system maintenance is definitely something that's necessary, as well as to reduce and eliminate chemical degradation of the membrane. All of these are were the primary things that were needing to be focused on for enhancing membrane for use in contaminated wastewater sources. The solution that we had come up with was to enhance existing osmosis membranes through surface modifications using two types of technologies that were up-and-coming technologies for enhancing membranes, that is the use of graphene oxide, as well as superhydrophilic nanoparticles. Both of these together were believed in tandem to enhance beyond what each individual component could do by itself. So to start this, we took it upon ourselves to really learn more about membrane fouling and how that happens in wastewater, to really build a better model for an accelerated testing process. The reason why an accelerated testing process was necessary is these membranes will be running for thousands and thousands of hours within a system in order to get an elevated fouling upon them. And we need to do this in a much faster time frame. And our initial fouling mechanisms that we were using used single components of organic and inorganic foulants that are known foulants, but were just not fouling fast enough for us. So we came across some very unique research that was published in the Journal of Membrane Science that showed that the combination of inorganic and organic foulants together in the right ratios can greatly accelerate the fouling mechanisms between them. In this case, the organic foulants can actually accelerate and build the mineral scaling and formation of, in this case, gypsum on the surface of membranes in cross-flow, forward, and reverse osmosis processes. So we took this upon ourselves at Lintech to try to come up with a process very similar to that using alginate and gypsum together, and we were able to demonstrate that this was, in fact, workable for our systems for creating a accelerated fouling within a forward osmosis process. So using this mechanisms, we were able to go forward to do our actual fouling tests. So So for the enhancement of the membranes, we chose two primary membranes that we were looking at. We looked at cellulose acetate as well as polyamide membranes. These two membranes are two of the most common osmosis membranes that are currently used in research and commercial applications. And what we see here is we see top-down SCM images of actual membranes. Starting on the left, you actually have a polyamide membrane. And polyamide membranes, highly common, very stable, very durable membranes. And what we see here is we see that they're actually very rough surface. And this rough surface actually does not lead it well to negate the fouling that can come through in a wastewater purification process that has a lot of contaminants. Our analysis of this showed that a typical water contact angle on this is about 70. So it's not hydrophobic, but it's definitely not super hydrophilic. We then modify this surface with graphene oxide, and we use polydopamine as a linking agent for the graphene oxide, which we found to be important for use, as in some scenarios, graphene oxide will actually float off of a membrane surface under heavy cross flow. So using the polydopamine, we found that it was very effective at sticking and maintaining the graphene oxide to the surface. But by putting the graphene oxide on the surface by itself, we found that we have improved stability now. Now, this stability is more of a durability, and it's a chemical durability that we found in most cases. As you can see from the water contact angle, it does not improve or change much at all. So this definitely does not form a super hydrophilic nature, even though it does add improvements in terms of durability. On the far right now, we were able to successfully add the super hydrophilic nanoparticles on top of the graphene oxide. It's important to note that we were able to put the super hydrophilic nanoparticles on the surface of both the pure polyamide as well as polyamide that was modified with the graphene oxide. That was a new challenge for us, as it was unknown whether or not we were going to be able to successfully adhere the super hydrophilic nanoparticles on top of membranes that had been modified with graphene oxide. In this case, we were able to show that it was successfully accomplished. And the super hydrophilic nanoparticles were very important in terms of improving the stability against the organic and inorganic foulants from not only forming but adhering to the surface of the membranes, making it more of a permanent fouling. And from this, we were able to show that the water contact angles from the membranes that were treated in this manner was greatly reduced, bringing about a super hydrophilic nature to the surface. As you can see from the bottom left of all of these SCM inserts, is actually the image taken from each of the water contact angle measurements. With more work, we believe we can get the water contact angle to be well below 10 degrees, which is going to be a matter of the amount of super hydrophilic nanoparticles that we can put on the surface. Next slide, we give kind of a base overview of the results of our membrane testing. Now, these tests were performed on a forward osmosis system, and the systems that we used had multiple steps, and each cycle was done with a baseline, which was done using pure deionized water, followed by a pure organic foulant, high concentration of pure organic foulant, followed by a high concentration of an inorganic foulant, followed by a washing step. And the washing step also included a run of pure water followed by that. And it was important to note that the way we did this, with the alginate being organic and the gypsum, in this case gypsum being calcium chloride and sodium sulfate in solution, was important that they were done in separate steps, because if we mix the gypsum and the alginate together, they will actually be crystallized and begin to form large gypsum crystals in the water prior to putting the water through the membrane for treatment. and that is a completely different fouling mechanism. In that case, they don't actually form on the surface and it passes through. So it's important to do them separate. And what we found is we compared these two, we compared a fully modified polyamide membrane with the graphene oxide and superhydrophilic nanoparticles to just a pure polyamide membrane. And what we found is we found that both membranes will actually show some water flux degradation due to fouling. However, the membranes that have been modified show great abilities to recover under simple washing steps. Now, this is important to note that that means that the fouling is actually occurring on the surface, but it is not adhering. So since it's not adhering, it can be fully washed away with a simple cleaning cycle. Now, in industrial processes, cleaning cycles are very common, and the rate at which they're done is dependent upon how fast the water flux drops below 75% of the initial flux. Now, we've learned from talking with different industrial partners that if the membrane cannot maintain a 75% water flux, then it needs to be replaced. And those replacements are really what brings about the large costs of using membranes in water purification cycles, the downtimes, the maintenance associated with that. That is where a lot of the issues come about. So the ability to recover, in this case, for the test that we did, fully recover the ability of it to get to its maximum water flux is highly desirable within the industrial process. And the foulants that we tested for this were sodium alginate, BSA, bovine serum, albumin, Suwannee River mud, which is just kind of a sediment that's been highly characterized, and then the calcium sulfate, which is the gypsum. So the next steps that we plan for this development is to continue to develop the membrane modification process. We want to expand what we've done with the cellulose acetate and polyamide membranes into other types of osmosis membranes that could be very useful for multiple types of wastewater purification processes, as one type of membrane may be favored over another type for various reasons. But also to expand this beyond just osmosis membranes, but also into nanofiltration and microfiltration, to really bring about the advantage of this modification process to multiple types of water purification using membranes. Continue to enhance the superhydrophilic nature to bring that water contact angle even lower than what we have now, because we believe that the lower the contact angle is, the better and stronger the anti-fouling nature will be. And then to continue to scale up. As anyone knows, these membranes are really a commodities market, and they have to be, in order for them to be viable on an industrial scale or any kind of commercial process, you need to be able to make these large scale. So to demonstrate that this modification process can be done at large scale is necessary. And then continue the testing beyond just for osmosis, but also to reverse osmosis. And I'd also add other types of filtration process like the nano and microfiltration. And then to take the testing that we've done in-house and then begin to add true wastewater testing using actual wastewater, but also instead of simulated wastewater, but also to then do third-party testing at outside sources. And that's all that I have for today, and thank you for your attendance and participation. And I'll take any questions that you have.
Thank you, David. That was a really informative overview of the technology that you're developing. At this time, I would encourage those of you participating online to utilize the Q&A window and to submit your questions so that they can be read online. I'm also going to give phone line participants a chance to ask their questions. To do that, you need to first unmute your line, and in order to do that, you need to hit #6. And after hitting #6 and asking your question, you can use *6 to put yourself back onto mute. So I'm going to open the phone lines and see if there are any questions. Again, pound six is what you use to unmute your line. We encourage questions for Dr. Battaglia, whether it's a clarifying question or a question about application or a question about what future directions are in the progress. So again, pound six to unmute your line. David, while we're waiting for people to ask questions, I just wanted to ask a clarifying question again. What is intended by, when you say wastewater, sometimes people think about municipal wastewater applications, and I wondered if you're thinking more broadly when you use the term wastewater, and if so, what is your thoughts on the application of your membranes for wastewater?
Well, wastewater itself is actually a very broadly defined term. It can be anything from municipally discharged water to runoff from a landfill or a contaminated site to water used in any kind of an industrial process that needs to go through any kind of a purification before it can be redischarged back into the environment. Some cases, wastewater purification can be the removal of large quantities of solids, in most cases visible solids, from the water before it can be discharged into a stream or such. In other cases, it can be water that was used in an industrial process and could have some small chemical contaminants within it that would have to then go through stringent purification processes before it can be discharged. Some processes that use this can be anything from pharmaceuticals to food processing or anything that brings in water and uses it for some kind of a secondary use that can then wants to discharge that water back into the environment.
Thank you. That answers the question very well. I appreciate that. Josh Smiraldi had a question for you. Have you looked into this application for membrane air diffusers?
I actually have not looked into that for membrane air diffusers. Most of the advantages of this being super hydrophilic for an air diffuser, I don't know if they have the same. It may or may not have the same viability. I've done a little bit of work with air diffusers, but not a lot. So I'm not really an expert in terms of telling you whether or not it would work or not. But that'd be something that would have to be investigated to really understand what you're looking for in terms of the improvement. But I personally have not looked at this type of technology for that application.
Okay, thank you. And just a clarifying question, especially for those who are not familiar with, you know, some of the technical terms that you're using. What is meant by water contact angle? I believe that's referring to slide three.
Well, water contact angle can be considered as the way the water will bead up on the surface, basically on any surface. If you have a super hydrophobic surface, then the water will not want to contact the surface at all and will almost completely bead up. If you have a super hydrophilic surface, then the water will want to completely spread itself out to contact the surface as much as possible. And what you're looking at at a water contact angle is you want to put a drop of water onto the surface, and then you want to then image that drop and create an angle to see how well it spreads itself out. And you can use this to gain knowledge on how hydrophilic or hydrophobic that surface is. In our cases, by looking at how hydrophilic the surface is, that gives us understanding on how much the water wants to contact the surface. And if we can obtain a very high contact of the water to the surface, then that, in many cases, can prohibit the fouling agents from getting to the surface to basically stop the water from going through.
Thank you. Another question is, what is the end of life of the membrane? Would this be recycled? Would it go into a landfill? What are your thoughts on that?
I do not know if they have specific recycling programs for membranes. From the industry people that I've talked to, most of the time they discard the membranes once they drop below that water flux that they consider necessary in order to continue using them. I'm not certain if different landfills have a recycling program for membranes, but I know from the industrial people that I know of that use those, they usually just discard them.
And I guess that'll depend too on what type of waste your membranes are, contain.
That is very true. If the membranes are contacting types of waste that need to be restricted in some way, then the membranes at the end of their lifetime will need to be handled in a more sensitive manner.
Another question came in. Could this membrane be used for treating hexavalent chromium?
I think potentially yes. That's one of the contaminants that can be found in some kinds of industrial runoff. So I'd say yes, it can. At what rate can it without fouling? I do not know until we'd actually test that one. We haven't really tested solvent contamination within water to determine that one. But it would be something that we can expand our research into looking into.
Okay, great. And so could be useful then for various types of metals as well as organic contaminants and materials that might be in the waste streams?
I would say so, yes. Because what we're doing is a lot of these membranes can handle a lot of these contaminants in terms of purifying them. What we're really doing is we're enhancing the ability and longevity of the membrane to perform its duty.
Gotcha. And then in terms of scale, where do you see this being the most optimal application? You mentioned fine applications like perhaps pharmaceuticals, but would you also be talking on larger scales like water treatment? Or either on a much larger scale for water treatment?
Well, for near term, it would most likely be used in smaller setups that require the purification of smaller amounts of water, perhaps pharmaceutical or smaller industrial wastewater systems. Larger scale wastewater systems, like what you see at like a water treatment plant, the amount of water that goes through there may be more than what most existing membrane systems can handle. And also it has to go with what type of membrane purification, even if the membrane purification is viable for that. Hopefully what we're looking at with this is we have the potential to open up membrane systems to being considered for some of those that they may not have been considered before, either because the scale of water flowing through was too much or because the amount of pollutants within the water was more than existing membranes could handle. Hopefully we get to a point where the enhancement and the scale in which we can produce modified membranes get to a point where membrane purification can even be considered for those now.
Great. I hope that we get to that point as well. Thank you very much for your questions. And to the audience, thanks for your questions. And to David, thank you for giving such good answers to the questions that you were presenting. At this point, if any further questions come in for Mr. Battaglia, no problem. We will pass those on to him. I'm sure he'll be glad to answer those. We are going to move on, however, to our next speaker, Steve Comfort, and from Airlift Environmental. Steve Comfort is currently a professor of soil and water chemistry at the School of Natural Resources at the University of Nebraska. For more than 20 years, he has dedicated his research to innovative treatments to remediate contaminated soil and water. Steve Comfort has mentored numerous MS and PhD graduate students and served as Mark Christensen Major Research Advisor, who founded the Airlift Environmental LLC company. Dr. Comfort and Christensen have developed a productive working relationship and are actively pursuing the goals of their STTR Phase 2 grant entitled Improving the Treatment of Contaminated Aquifers by Developing Direct Push Oxidant Candles with Pneumatic Circulators. So at this point, I would like to pass it off to Steve and Mark, too, if he's also on the line.
Okay. Thank you, Heather, and thank you all for tuning in today. Again, I'm Steve Comfort, and I'm going to talk about our use of slow-release oxidants to treat contaminated groundwater. I'm going to begin with a little background information and explain how Airlift got started. Back in 2005, I received a federal earmark grant entitled Developing Innovative Treatments for Contaminated Soil and Water. In 2009, we were on the tail end of that grant, and we were looking for one more site in the state of Nebraska to work with. The Nebraska Department of Environmental Quality hooked me up with the city of Cozad, which is a small town out in western Nebraska. They had an abandoned landfill that had contaminated their groundwater with TCE. We had just come off treating an RDX plume with a liquid oxidant, and we're thinking about doing the same thing. However, upon evaluation of the site, we found that the contamination was located in a very low permeable zone of the aquifer. Fearful that it may have been difficult to inject a liquid oxidant into that silty clay layer, and given that the grant was entitled Developing Innovative Treatments, we decided to try something different. We began manufacturing slow-release oxidants by mixing mostly permanganate with some wax, molding them into shapes of cylinders and calling them oxidant candles. To be fair, we were not the first ones to come up with the idea of slow-release oxidants. If you go back in the literature, you'd find publications dating back to 2004 from Purdue University, 2005 Clemson. A number of papers came out in 2007 from Ohio State University. But in 2009, when we were working on this, we were unaware of anyone who had tried to deploy these things in a field setting. So throwing caution to the wind, we decided to go for it, and we began manufacturing hundreds of these oxidant candles in my laboratory using, believe it or not, a single hot plate. We put them in the aquifer in one of two ways. We used a geoprobe where we drove the rod down into the aquifer, dropped the candle into the rod, pulled the rod back out. Those are 2-inch diameter candles covering 15 feet of aquifer. We also made 3-inch diameter candles, put them in their own screen carriers, and dropped them down 10 permanent wells. Equal masses of oxidant were deployed by both treatments. The idea was that once we put these candles in this low permeable zone, they would eventually diffuse out and intercept the TCE plume. What we realized later is that when we put the candles in wells, we're essentially putting them in a column of water. And when the permanganate starts to dissolve, it's a cohesive molecule that wants to stick together, stack on top of each other, and move downward. To prevent that from happening, we started bubbling air at the base of the candle, and as shown in our flow boxes here, we got much better coverage with aeration than without. So in 2010, we added bubblers to these candles that were in wells. Continuing on, Mark Christensen was the lead graduate student of this project. He graduated in 2011. In 2012, the first publication from his work came out. That's also the year he formed Airlift Environmental. He and I then submitted proposals, and in 2013, we received a phase one, and September of 2015, a phase two. In 2016, the second paper from this COZAD site came out, so let me just briefly explain what we can conclude from this five-year study. If we look at the concentrations down gradient versus up gradient, what we find is that on average we got an 89% reduction in TCE and associated degradants. Because we pull the candles out once a year to take a look at them, we're estimating that these candles still have about 5 more years of longevity left in them. And if that's true, that would make 10 years of treatment from a single deployment of these oxidant candles. For candles put in by direct push, we stopped seeing positive results from these after the first year. Why? Because the candles in their original formulation have a propensity to form an oxide scale on them. Last summer, we went out and tried to uncover these candles. We found a fragment of it that had been in the aquifer for 5 years, and you can see that it has a very thin oxide scale on it that's impervious to water. As part of our phase one research, we started reformulating the candles, added an anti-scaling agent to it. I'm plotting permanganate release versus time. This is the original formulation. This is the newer formulation. So we're hopeful that these kind of second-generation candles will work better for us in the future. But given the results that we obtained with the candles and the aeration, the rest of our phase one research was, could we possibly develop prototypes of these candles with aerators that could be inserted with direct push? We came up with a couple different designs. For brevity, I'm just going to show two and say that they basically differ by where the airline is. In one, the airline comes out along the outside of the borehole, bubbles up into a screen that holds the candle. The other one, everything's intact inside this 2 1/4 inch rod. Again, they're put in with a geoprobe. There's a trench for the airlines. These airlines are hooked up to a manifold, which is hooked up to a compressor that periodically comes on during the day. After we're done installing it, everything's below ground except the shed that's holding the compressor. So we put these in at a different location, and here's how they worked. We had a number of VOCs in the groundwater to start with. You can see at 65, 72 days after candle installation, we got a lot of non-detects. We picked up permanganate in the well 72 days after treatment. And even this well that was 80 feet down gradient was showing a decrease in contaminant concentrations. So to continue on with this work then, for our phase two research, we have enough funding now to do more sites and kind of refine our treatment. So our goal is to treat 4 sites over the next 2 years and collect multiple samplings so we can really document the efficacy of these treatments. We're also interested in the spacing requirements for these candles. So I had a wide flow box made specifically for this project. It has a clear end plate that allows us to see the architecture of the oxidant plume coming off the candle. To model this, as you can imagine, is not an easy thing to do. You have to work with the dissolution of the oxidant from the candle. You have to consider the advection of the water moving past the candle, and essentially you have air sparging beneath the candle causing turbulent flow. So trying to couple all three of those processes is challenging, to say the least, and fortunately for us, the smarter people on the team are working on that. Dr. Yifeng Li is a modeler at UNL. She's also being funded by this research, and she's working with two of our graduate students on this problem. So to conclude, some benefits and limitations. These larger diameter candles can provide multiple years of service. What we view, what we did at COSAD, is kind of a fallback treatment that pretty much anyone could implement. It's a safe approach because you can be reasonably assured that you're going to get multiple years of service from the candles. If you want to put them in by direct push, well, then you don't have the well cuttings. And in comparison to a liquid injection, there's no chemical tanks, no mixing, irritating dust, or a need for a large water source. There's sustained release, so the chances for contaminant rebound are going to be less. You can put them in low permeable material, right? And also with aeration, you can increase the sweeping efficiency or the amount of coverage in the aquifer with these candles. In terms of limitation, we don't see this technology as a silver bullet. There's going to be limitations. In comparison to a liquid oxidant, obviously we're putting less mass in per injection point. And although the smaller candles are easier to put in, they may only last a year or so. So there's some trade-off going to a smaller diameter candle. Other things is we haven't vetted how well the anti-scaling agent's going to work in the field. We don't have the spacing requirements figured out yet, but my gut feeling tells me that it's never going to be 10 feet. It's going to have to be less than that. So if you have a very wide plume, this may not be the treatment of choice. And really, there's just very limited. They've been put in on a limited basis, and there's just limited data available. And so that's one thing that the phase two will hopefully address. In terms of things on the horizon for us, At some point, we'd like to get away from using a wax as the matrix to deliver the oxidant. We'd like to have something that would deliver the oxidant without that density-driven flow that I showed you earlier. We've experimented with a few things, some success, but we're still, you know, a little ways away from kind of presenting that or trying to publish something on that. And then ideally, to address the limitation of limited mass per drive point, what we'd really like to be able to do is to put these candles in with a geoprobe and then seal it up, but then be able to come back a year or so whenever the candle's spent, relocate it, pull it out, and reload it. And so we have a design that will let us do that, and we've presented it to the state, and we're kind of waiting to see if they're going to allow us to use that kind of treatment in the future. So with that, I'll leave you with some contact information. If you're interested in any of the publications that we have on this topic, the attachment that I put to the presentation has links that take you right to the papers that anyone can download free of charge, courtesy of UNL's Digital Commons. And if there are questions on patents or IP, I would ask that you address New Tech Ventures. Whenever the university does joint research, the IP stays with the university, and New Tech Ventures is the agency that handles that, and they'd be more than happy to answer your questions. Finally, let me just conclude by thanking NIH for the funding. Obviously, none of this would have been possible without it. And I also want to acknowledge the students, both the graduate and undergraduates, who contributed to this research. They're the ones that generate the data. And without the data, it wouldn't be anything to report. So I very much appreciate their efforts. So with that, I'll conclude my presentation.
Thank you so much, Steve. That was a very thorough presentation and certainly gave us a good idea of how it can be used and what the strengths and maybe limitations of the technology are. At this time, we have time for questions, and I'd like to invite people who are on the phone, if you'd like to ask a question, you just need to hit pound and then 6, and that will unmute your line. So let's give just a minute for that. Again, pound and 6 will unmute your phone line to ask a question. And in the meantime, those of you who are listening online are welcome to submit your questions through the Q&A pod. A question that came in, and of course, Steve, one of the advantages of having these webinars is that you learn about other people who are doing similar research involved in technologies, you know, like what you're developing. And so a question came in, if you were familiar with the work at CDM Smith, Patrick Evans was named in particular as somebody who's doing something kind of similar to what you're proposing.
I've never met him. I believe they're working on 1,4-dioxane with the slow-release persulfate, and we're doing the same, and we're working on that publication. Should be ready sometime this year.
Okay, great. And again, just to point out, as Steve mentioned, there is your publications are listed in the additional resources page. So I really appreciate that you posted that information. Are there any other questions from the phone participants? And I'd like to ask if Sarah Mishmandani sees other questions that have come in online, if you would ask them on my behalf, because I seem to be having some technical issues with my question and answer pod.
Sure. So a couple of questions have come in. So one is, are there different formulas of these candles depending on what contaminant you're trying to treat?
Yeah, the two that we worked with is, so for any chlorinated solvents, you know, double-bonded carbon chlorinated solvents, permanganate, and then for BTEX compounds, we used persulfate. So there's both. We use both oxidants.
Great. Thank you. Another question that came through is, what size contaminant can this technology handle? How large are you targeting? I'm sorry, what size contaminated sealed site? Like, what size of the contamination?
Yeah, like I said, the spacing requirements, you know, maybe 3 feet, 5 feet if they were staggered. So, you know, that's ideally it would be best for like a small underground leaking storage tank to nip it off and so it doesn't migrate. But a big, you know, several football fields long, I don't think this is the technology you want to use. So it's got to be kind of a narrower plume that you want to contain, keep it from moving off-site, or if you want to put them in, you've got the source area nailed down and you want to put them in that area, it would probably work for that as well.
Great, thank you. Another question that has come in is, have you tried with creosote contamination?
Creosol?
Yes.
We've done PAHs, so the permanganate candles worked well with that. So I think it would work okay.
And Heather, are you able to see the questions yet, or do you want me to keep going?
Yes, I can see the questions.
Okay.
Thank you, Sarah. I must have lost my my privileges as a moderator, so I'll try to do a better job so I don't lose my privileges. So, Steve, another question that came in, have you conducted any cost analysis to deploy this technology?
You know, just
kind of on a per whole unit basis.
Yeah, I mean, we have, we had to do that, you know, for the commercialization plan, and I don't have those numbers in front of me, but if they want to contact me directly, you know, I can share what we've come up with, what the cost would be per drive point, you know, covering 15, 20 feet of aquifer. I didn't pull those up to look at, so I don't remember exactly what they are.
Okay, that's fair enough. We can put you in contact with the person who asked the question.
All right.
And at this point, we don't have any more questions that have come in online. So, again, if any folks do come up with a question and you want to ask it, feel free to go ahead and send it. Just mention that you meant for this question to go towards Steve Comfort from Airlift Environmental, and we will be glad to forward that question to him. Steve, I want to thank you very much for giving this presentation and walking us through your technology and sharing your recent publications as well. At this point, I will move on to our next speaker, Philippe DeCleva and Scott Noblet from Microchemica. Philippe received his bachelor's in mechanical engineering from Rochester Institute of Technology in 1987 and his MS in materials science and engineering from Case Western Reserve University in 1992. He has 23 years of experience in product development in both aerospace and medical instrumentation industries. He is a founding member of Microchemica LLC, as well as a founding member and lead engineer of Advanced Microlabs LLC, which has recently been acquired by a top analytical instrumentation company. Scott Noblet is the senior chemist working for the Microchemical LLC. He graduated summa cum laude with Bachelor of Science degree in Chemical Engineering and Chemistry from Rose Holman Institute of Technology in 2005. He is a chemistry graduate student at Colorado State University and was awarded an EPA Star Fellowship. He obtained his PhD in 2011, and his postdoctoral work was performed at Scripps Institute of Oceanography under Greg Roberts. This focused on building microchip electrophoresis instruments for coupling to a cloud condensation nuclei, CCN, collector for directly measuring CCN chemistry. Scott then transitioned to a research position at Colorado State University, where he continued to develop microchip microphoresis technology. So at this point, I'd like to pass it off to Philippe and Scott to talk about rapid and inexpensive alternatives for ion analysis, online microchip electrophoresis.
Hello, thank you very much, Heather, and thank you everyone for attending this webinar. As Heather mentioned, we are Microchemica. We were at one point Advanced Microlabs, and Advanced Microlabs was the awardee of the grant, but since the purchase of Advanced Microlabs, we've had to remove that name, and Microchemica now works in the environmental world, if you will, addressing ion analysis there for environmental purposes as well as others. So if there's any confusion on that, that hopefully that clears things up. Okay, first, what do we do? The problem that there is that there's ionic contaminants in the environment, most of them man-made, some not. Specific. Some examples are perchlorate, selenium, sulfate, nitrate, metals. And I'll, to address, just using perchlorate as an example, there are remediation processes or steps that remove perchlorate. However, they have no way, perhaps, of knowing when their filtration or their resin bed or their process is saturated. And we've developed an online, inexpensive online instrument to hopefully reduce their costs, as well as give rapid results in an online real-time manner. Currently, to do that, it's difficult. Ion chromatography is considered the gold standard for this kind of work, but the equipment is expensive. Online, while not impossible, is difficult to maintain in a reliable manner, and it can require rather large sample volumes. And in some applications, the user doesn't have large volumes of sample to lose, especially if you're getting water out of a small aquifer and you're trying to test for perchlorate. You may only have milliliters, not gallons, or you know, hundreds of milliliters. So we've developed a way to use microfluidic chemical separation that we could do quick analysis as quickly as 1 minute. If the conditions are correct or lined up correctly. We require low volumes of sample, as well as low volumes of buffer that is needed to work with the analyte in question. So 100 milliliters of sample or 100 milliliters of buffer could last weeks, if not longer, reducing the need to go and swap out consumables. You can leave it unattended. If need be. And because we use contact conductivity, our detection limits are in the neighborhood of 10 ppb or less. The lower rates or lower levels are dependent on the matrix. There are some chemistry limitations, but if we know what they are ahead of time, we've been able to surmount those to a degree. We can also measure species that don't absorb light. If you will, competing, if you will, with the fluorescence type technologies. So here's our technology. The picture below is our bench instrument, but we've been able to miniaturize the separation and the analysis instrumentation into this bench top, which is roughly about the size of a shoebox. It uses a microchip, roughly about the size of a glass slide, 1 by 3 inches, and it measures ionic or charged species, both cations and anions, or we're capable of doing both. The samples are in solution, water, ethanol, or we can also do aerosols, provided they could be dissolved in liquids, put in solution. Another benefit to our technology is that we could measure multiple species. The plot on the right shows with one injection the measurement of chloride, sulfate, nitrate, oxalate, our internal standard, and a small peak at the bottom is formate. So this is not just a one analyte test. If there's a suite of analytes that are in close proximity from a molecular mobility, molecular weight point of view, we can analyze multiple with the same injection. And again, all done within minutes. You can see the time second. In less than 1 minute, we've measured, well, 5 peaks plus an internal standard. The novelty of what we do, long-term operation. You could leave it unattended for weeks, maybe even months. which is unique for microfluidic or electrophoresis systems. A lot of the work that's been done in using microfluidic capillary electrophoresis has been like point of care, one-time use, which no one's had to really look at trying to do long-term usage of this technology, but we're one of the first ones to do that. Our design is robust, dealing with, so we can, while we do some filtration, but we can handle a certain amount of insolubles, and our current design is such that air bubbles, should they pop up in the lines, are not an issue. Again, going on speed and performance, for PPB level measurements, we could do in approximately 1 minute for analysis. Precision is as good as 0.5%. But we can also sacrifice, because of the dynamic range of our technology, we could sacrifice speed for improved sensitivity and precision if need be. There's ways that we have a range of detection parameters that could assist people in that area. A big area of benefit is our cost. Our instrumentation is projected to cost between $20,000 and $50,000. Anyone who's bought an IC device knows it's considerably more expensive than that. So the cost is saved both in capital and consumables. It would be expected, there's a picture of a microchip on the side in the slide here that can go for months at a time. Consumable, same thing. You have to replace or replenish the internal standard as well as the buffer when you replace the chip, or it's convenient to do all at once. The small footprint, you saw I described, the chip is 1 by 3 inches, and the earlier photograph showed a detector and power supply about the size of a shoebox. Currently, we have a benchtop format. We're in development of doing an online real-time instrument for field analysis in the area of for both perchlorate. A customer is doing perchlorate remediation, as well as we have a grant with the EPA doing aerosols. Our target analytes are sulfate, nitrate, selenate, perchlorate, fluoride, acetate, ammonium. You see the list there. We could do metals, provided they're soluble in water. We do have some limitations to our technology. The target species must be able to be charged. We use high voltage to drive the ions through our microchip to pass over the detection wires that we have inside. There is a limit to the temperature. It's best if it works below 50 degrees C, or B, meaning, say, if this is in a shed or in a building, it's best that it be below 50 degrees C, and, of course, it could be difficult in places like Southern California near the desert, where there's a lot of perchlorate. We do have limits on detection limits, if depending on the matrix conductivity or solution conductivity. For instance, in distilled water, we can measure well below 1.1 ppb, but as you get into saltier solutions such as seawater, it's more in the range of ppm. We have some ways we could reduce it, but there are limitations to that as well. Some of our applications, like I said, aerosol composition, sulfate and ethanol. While not maybe necessarily an environmental issue, it's the production. They need it for the EPA. They've got mandates on how much sulfate they can produce. The perchlorate remediation was the bulk of our work. But there's also others on request we could do, depending on the chemistry. The chemistry evaluation is what we would have to do. This work was courtesy of an NIH grant that we were awarded. And also we currently have an EPA grant that we're finishing up. We have several patents on this. The top one, the first one, the non-fluidic microdetection device, is through CSU, through Professor Chuck Henry, of whom Scott Noblet was a student, and that's through Colorado State University, and we have exclusive license to this. We've also developed a couple other patents around the system, around the instrument. And if you need some, perhaps more information, we did publish in the area of monitoring chloride and sulfate in a steam power plant in power plant chemistry publication in January 2013. We published an article explaining in perhaps greater detail what our technology could do. So thank you very much for your time. If you have any questions, we'll take them. If not, there's contact info here, phone number and email, and hopefully we'll get you a quick response to address your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Philippe. Yeah, it's great to learn more about your technology and see all those pictures to give us a good idea of what it's going to look like as it's coming along. At this time, there's plenty of time to ask questions. Those of you who are online, you can submit it via the Q&A box. Those of you who are listening can think about your question and press pound and six to unmute your phone line. We did get a couple of questions that came in about your technology. What are you using to filter the media from contaminants? I guess before the detection section to remove contaminants, what are you using to filter the
media? Sorry, this is Scott.
Hi, Scott.
I'm the PhD chemist at Microchemica. I'm not quite sure exactly what contaminants they're talking about. In general, if they're talking about insolubles, the current way that we're doing the injection actually avoids the neutral uncharged species entirely from entering the system. And so avoiding the insolubles is pretty easy that way. So in general, a lot of times we don't even have to filter the samples. I think a couple of slides ago, there was actually a picture with like a series of vials that were getting more and more yellow. We were able to actually inject those samples without doing any prior filtration.
And so clarification came in. They're talking about impurities in terms of contaminants. It's still the same question, though, that the technology still works despite impurities, is what you're saying?
Yeah, well, if it's impurities in the sense of other ions that could be charged, if the chemistry of the buffer isn't tailored to those, then I shouldn't say it will not be an issue, but we can, through software control and injection times, we could move that issue out of the way, if you will.
Yeah, I think maybe the clarification that is needed here is that this is a separation technology inherently. So that means if you have some sort of impurity, let's say that you're trying to measure nitrate, but there's also chloride, those are just naturally separated by this technique. And then they're detected after the separation step. Is that kind of the impurity that they're talking about?
Yes, thank you. That was what they were looking for. And that makes sense. Thank you, Scott. And just, you know, out of curiosity, especially given the recent issue in Flint, Michigan, would this technology be useful either for, testing whether the conditions of water in a pipeline change significantly and or whether even the lead question is if that's possible?
So this technology could theoretically be used for something like lead in a pipeline. That's an application we've never actually pursued. Heavy metals can just be difficult in general because they do tend to complex with a variety of different organic species that are dissolved in the water and can cause fouling and that kind of thing. So while certainly possible, that's just something we've not pursued. Now, if you were doing if you were just wanting to monitor something like nitrate or phosphate in a water line, that would be relatively straightforward to do.
Thanks. Are there any other questions? Please submit by the Q&A box, or again, you can press pound six, and that will unmute your phone line. And there was a question that came in maybe in advance of your clarification just about the detection range of your device. So you said it's not only the low range of parts per billion, but you also have the parts per million analysis. But I just wanted to make sure that that question was answered. I believe you answered that in your presentation.
Yeah, just for a little bit of clarification, the sensitivity does depend on the sample matrix. For instance, seawater we're much less sensitive to than something like tap water. But typically, our linear range is on the order of a factor of about 1,000. So if your detection limit is about 1 ppb, you should be able to get good response to at least 1 ppm, if that makes sense. Whereas in a more difficult sample, something like a seawater where your detection limit is close to 1 ppm, then you could probably measure all the way up to about 1 part per 1,000, if that makes sense. So you've got a range of about 3 orders of magnitude. It's just that range can kind of depend on what your sample matrix is.
That makes sense. Thanks for clarifying that. Well, I think at this point, again, if there are any further questions for the Microchemica team, we are happy to forward those questions, and their emails are also available, so you can contact them directly if there are any need to get in touch with them. But I'd like to take this time to thank Philippe and Scott for your presentation and sharing your technology with us. At this time, I'd like to introduce Fatima Shirazi from MicroV Biotechnologies. Fatima has been the CEO for MicroV Biotech since 2008. She is the inventor of MicroV's platform technology called Microniche Engineering, MNE, where the microenvironments of the biological systems are synthetically designed to enhance microbial physiology and enzymatic performance. In 2001, she was the recipient of the Jack Edward McKee Award for her professional achievements in groundwater protection, restoration, and sustainable use. Dr. Shirazi was previously with Black & Veatch as the Vice President of Technology for a boutique water engineering firm. She is an inventor of 12 patents granted or pending. And we'd like to thank you, Fatima, for presenting your technology and letting us know how it's going. Pass it off to you now.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for this webinar. If I could just start with the second slide. Our technology, basically the topic of this presentation will be about 1,4-dioxin technology for water treatment. I would like to just cover a few topics for this presentation, briefly touch on the 1,4-dioxin problem and some of the limitations we have in terms of the technologies. And then I will talk about a little bit about approaches for biological processes and why MicroV solution is unique in that respect. We talk about a little bit about demonstration and advantages of our technology and some applications, and then some reference for this project. This is our phase two NIH grant. The phase one was quite successful, and we have started phase two and is scaling up the technology and demonstrating at large scale at one of the sites here in San Jose. Going to slide number three, the sources and uses of 1,4-dioxin is quite widespread. We have industrial application, and 1,4-dioxin is being widely used for pharmaceutical and also, plastic and other other industries. And 1,4-dioxin basically is a soluble, is solvent stabilizer. One of the major issues that we have, at least in the wastewater treatment, aside from the remediation, is that majority of the municipal wastewater treatments are not able to remove 1,4-dioxin with current processes. The limitation that we have is MCL has not been set for 1,4-dioxin, but some states have adopted 1 ppb, which is very low, but some other states, you know, the limits are between 3 to 85. Some of the technologies that have been applied for this pollutant are carbon absorption, you know, air stripping, bioaugmentation, and biostimulation, specifically for remediation processes. And unfortunately, it's still the problem has not been resolved. The issue with biological processes are many. I can just talk about a few of those problems with conventional biological processes. One, of course, is we typically deal with low organism density. Therefore, we need to have large volume reactors or setup or treatment zones to be able to treat 1,4-dioxin. Specifically for bioaugmentation and biostimulation, we are dealing with a stressful environment and stressful conditions. And typically, we have issues with efficiency and competition by other organisms that really have nothing to do with 1,4-dioxin treatment. So Makovi began to work on a technology that could potentially offer a breakthrough for treatment of 1,4-dioxin. Through phase one, we were able to establish that concept that you should be able to create environments for organisms that are responsible for degradation of 1,4-dioxin. And regardless whether you use this technology in a reactor setup or perhaps in in-situ treatment process, you should be able to focus mainly on one species of organism with the ability to degrade dioxin without interference from other biological perhaps organisms or bacteria that may be in the water. So with that, the concept is relatively easy. Once we have the biocatalyst, and I will go to this slide second in a second, but basically slide number five is giving you an idea as how this technology works. With focusing on just one culture that has one organism that has the ability to degrade 1,4-dioxin under different operating conditions, and being able to create what we call biocatalysts, a specific environment that is designed for that organism, for that specific process, you are intensifying that biological process. And this biocatalyst composite that specifically has been developed for 1,4-dioxin has the ability to treat other organics, for example, chlorinated solvents. And one of the key advantages of the technology is being able to reduce the footprint. And again, going back to that intensification of the technology, we're able to have relatively low retention time for treatment of water. One of the innovative feature of the technology is that you will not have to have recycle treatment after this, the reactor that we designed. And we have not seen over the course of specifically phase two and also phase one that we are not generating any secondary waste stream, that you have to come up with another treatment process. The next page is showing the system, two reactors in series, obtaining the water from a very large holding tank. This site is a very remote site in San Jose, and they have a relatively low concentration of dioxin, something between 10 to 15 parts per billion. And being able to treat that to less than five, and sometimes two PPB is a great advantage for this facility. Right now, this facility is using UV oxidation, and the UV oxidation is extremely energy intense, and so therefore it's really desirable to be able to offer almost a self-sustainable process that doesn't need a lot of babysitting and doesn't need a lot of training, a trained operator or anything like that. So this system has been in operation since last August, and it's producing great results. Some of the technical advantages of the technology, of course, is the ability to have, as we talked, you know, high density of organisms in a specific organism, reducing the footprint and lowering the chemical usage of the technology. As we talked, no operator really needed. The system is fully contained and very sustainable, and no secondary waste to stream. And, you know, based on our analysis and the past experience we have had, the biocatalysts can be in operation for more than 10 years and without any need to change out the biocatalysts. Some of the applications of the technology, of course, our drinking water. We have been able to see that the one-for dioxin can impact our drinking water at very low concentration, very similar to wastewater treatment. We really don't have a process that could treat one-for dioxin, remove one-for dioxin. And some of the common technologies that are being used in drinking water, such as activated carbon, really is not effective for removal of one-for dioxin. So this technology has application beyond groundwater treatment, mainly in drinking water, wastewater treatment, industrial wastewater. One of the interesting things that we did in phase one, which was really not focusing on low concentration, but various, you know, wide range of concentration, we looked at 75 ppm all the way to, 150 or 50 ppb, and we wanted to look at the technology and find out what the limitations are in terms of the incoming concentrations. And fortunately, we were able to show that regardless of the concentration, influent concentration, we're able to remove one-for dioxin to very low limit of, I believe we achieved 2 parts per billion, which is really very significant when it comes to low concentration and requirement of many of states we talked about. Basically, the next slide is really this project would not be possible without the NIH support. We do have a paper coming up on in-situ treatment of groundwater containing one-for dioxin. We also have a patent pending. And as you can see, our team are in this picture. Everyone is smiling. The project has been quite successful, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Fatima. We did get a few questions that came in online, so I'll be reading those in a minute. Anyone else who has questions, please look to the Q&A box and just type in your question, and I'll be able to read that on your behalf. So the one of the questions that came in is whether this can be used to treat 1,4 dioxane in groundwater.
So in groundwater, two configurations would be usable. One would be pump and treat, of course, and the other one would be in-situ treatment. We have primarily focused on the above-ground pump and treat configuration.
Right, and I guess the in-situ was kind of the nuance of their question.
An in-situ application would be basically some kind of a biobarrier, perhaps configuration that you will direct the water through a barrier. The biocatalyst can be configured into a treatment zone, and that is one way of approaching it.
Okay, great. Certainly the pump and treat is the first tier to work out. Another question that came in, what is the highest concentration of 1,4-dioxane that has been tested?
I think I just touched on that. 75,000 ppb was the highest concentration we have tested.
Okay, great. And getting it down to?
2 ppb.
2 ppb, great. Question that came in, how can HRTs in the range of 2 to 6 hours make this technology viable for a point of use application?
It's a great question. Depending on the concentration, you could be on the lower side of that HRT. And although, 2 hours may seem to be long, but comparing to other technologies that have much, much longer retention time would be very, very competitive. The 2 hours retention time is basically the time that you need to treat much lower concentration because, the ability of organism to utilize lower concentration will be reduced as the concentration will be, will be lower than typical. But that's really the reality we deal with in, Superfund sites or wastewater. The typical retention time in wastewater, if you think about it, we are talking about 6 to 8 hours retention time, sometimes even higher in an activated sludge or type of treatment that you deal with wastewater. And it's not really uncommon for even drinking water to have 2 to 6 hours retention time. Again, as you might imagine, we are dealing with lower concentration than the higher concentration.
Thank you. That certainly puts it into perspective. Are there any other questions that we can ask Dr. Shirazi? If you have questions, just submit them through the Q&A panel. And you also have the option of hitting pound and 6 to unmute your phone line. So another question has come in. Was the 75,000 parts per billion reduced to 2 parts per billion, or is there an order of magnitude reduction?
We were able to achieve 2 parts per billion, and I want to just make sure that it's completely clear. The 75,000 ppb, it was our intention to show this concentration. Therefore, we made it synthetic water. You will hardly find any place that you see any 75,000 ppb. That's very uncommon. For us to just show the breadth of the technology, we decided to look at higher concentration and lower concentration. And then to really answer your question, every time we tested the effluent from our reactor, we were able to achieve 2 parts per billion.
Great. Thank you for that clarification.
I also want to add something else, that the efficiency of the system, as we started with high concentration, was lower than when we continue our study during phase one. So with that, the higher concentration took longer for us to achieve low effluent concentration. As we moved on to 100 or 50 ppb, the retention time, at least in our laboratory, was around 30 minutes. So that put the 2 to 6 hours HRT in perspective.
certainly does. And I guess, I found it interesting, too, that the target level is going to vary by state as well, but certainly being in California, they tend to be conservative. Conservative in terms of the levels that contamination levels are set for. So I think it's great the levels that you're able to achieve.
But it is still not the same level that they want. They want one part per billion. And I'm not 100% sure if anyone can detect one part per billion, but that's the notification that we have received, that one part per billion is the lower limit that they are looking. And if you have 35 parts per billion, then the well is going to be shut down.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, I think it's wonderful that you're developing a technology that can be used to help us clean up the 1,4-dioxane. It's certainly an issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we don't seem to have any more questions at the moment. But again, if questions come up, we encourage the audience to contact our speakers directly. The email contact information is available from the seminar homepage. And I know that they would love to hear feedback, ideas, questions, technology. Again, these researchers are in the process of putting tweaks on their new technologies, and getting the feedback from practitioners in the field is extremely valuable. And I think that today the questions that have come in have been very helpful in understanding, you know, what some of the needs are out there. So we appreciate our audience participation certainly in this webinar. And I certainly want to thank our behind-the-scenes people, Jean Ballant, Justin Crane, Sarah Mishmandani, and Pete Riddle. They're all behind the scenes today helping us make this webinar be a success. So at this point, again, I encourage any additional questions. You can still send them through the Q&A, and we can send them off to our presenters, or just go to the seminar homepage and find their email addresses and start a little dialogue with our presenters that way. So before we conclude, I did want to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. And this will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation, and those materials will still be there. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. And we certainly ask that you would consider filling this out. We look at your comments, and we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanism. So we certainly encourage you to respond. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. We know that's very important for those of you who have continuing credit needs within your company or your academic institution. So I would like to remind everybody and remind the participants of various ways to stay connected to ensure that you don't miss any future webinars. More information on EPA's CLUIN webinars can be found on the CLUIN.org website, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page. Follow EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter, or you can join the Cleanup Information Network LinkedIn group. Also, you can visit the SRP Progress in Research webpage. And we have another Twitter option, the SRP_NIEHS Twitter. We also want to encourage everyone to join us this Wednesday. We have another webinar, and it will be from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And this time we're going to focus still on water, but the session speakers are going to talk about their innovative technologies for detection of hazardous substances in water. And again, this will focus on our small business innovative research grantees. So we have, Our email is on the seminar homepage and CLUIN. Again, if you submitted a question online that we didn't have time to get to, we will respond by email. And at this time, I certainly want to thank our investigators for preparing their presentations today. As a reminder, I'm going to pull up. We heard from Lintec, Airlift Environmental, Microchemica, and Microbi Biotechnologies. And again, we want to thank these small businesses for their work in developing new technologies for remediation of hazardous substances. And at this time, I would like to thank those of you who tuned in and conclude today's webinar.